an action that looked like it looked like this. That was a Jacobi action we looked at earlier. But we made the substitution where every time we have d by d lambda, we substitute that with a covariant derivative with some connection that looked like like this. Okay. So we had these new fields, introduces these new fields, omega, called auxiliary fields. There's one for each dimension of the group symmetry. These guys, the t's, were the generators vector. Right. So so you put this every time you see a derivative, and that's supposed to gauge the particular spatial symmetry that you're interested in. Right. So so then we've calculated the momenta, and then we found that they satisfy constraints. So the first constraint is the scalar constraint that the Jacobi theory on its own satisfied. So it looked like basically the kinetic energy plus the potential is equal to zero. All right. So that's the first one. The second one. So this is the, people call this the Hamiltonian constraint. And it will be, in general relativity, this will all be the scalar Hamiltonian constraint, general relativity. The second one was a linear constraint, and it was in turn, it was relating the momentum conjugate to the auxiliary fields, to the momentum conjugate to the q's. And that guy look like pi alpha, which is the momentum conjugate to this, is basically equal to this thing. And remember this piece, for example, if you, the intuition you get, if you stick in the generators of the rotation group, this is a cross product. So this thing looks like the total angular momentum for rotations. For translations, this guy is just a derivative with respect to q. So what you get is the total momentum. So basically, this piece is sort of like the nether current associated to a particular symmetry involved, global symmetry that you have. And what you're doing is you're saying that that whole thing is equal to zero. Well, is equal to the momentum of this guy, right? And this is a linear constraint. And in general relativity, let me write down the last one, which is just pi equals zero. So this thing is the thing that's enforcing our free endpoint condition. Because if you remember, the variation that we're doing with respect to these auxiliary fields is not the usual sort of variation that you would do. The way that you want to do the variation is to keep the boundaries, the endpoints, free. So you're sort of doing this, basically the surface term that we normally get in variation is now no longer equal to zero. So in order to guarantee that the whole variation is equal to zero everywhere, you have to impose this extra constraint. And that's called, I call it the Mach constraint, or you can think of it as a free endpoint condition. And we're going to see today that this thing is really the thing that's implementing the background independence. So this is the constraint that's making the beta the r relational. So if you plug this into here, it's saying that the total momentum is equal to zero. And that's different from Newtonian mechanics. In Newtonian mechanics, these momenta are generally conserved quantities. Right? But in the Bartoli theory, you have this extra condition, this extra principle that's telling you that instead of having a just conserved quantity that depends on the boundary conditions, that conserved quantity is equal to zero. Okay. So when you plug this into here, it looks like the diffeomorphism constraint in general relativity. When you're working with GR. Alright, so the last thing is that we found that we calculated the Hamiltonian and we found it was zero, the canonical Hamiltonian. So the total Hamiltonian is just going to be proportional to the constraints. So we have these Lagrange multipliers times the constraints. So this was the Hamiltonian. The next thing we did was we worked out Poisson brackets. So because the Hamiltonian is proportional to the constraint, we have to check that the evolution equations are going to preserve the constrained surface. So if you start on a constrained surface, you have to check that the equation's motions are not going to evolve you away from that constraint surface. And the way to do that is to check that the constraints commute with the Hamiltonian. But because the Hamiltonian is just a linear combination of constraints, what you really need to check is that the constraints commute with each other. So if the constraints commute with each other, then you have a closed system, which is what you need. Otherwise, you can get secondary constraints that also be satisfied. Luckily, we don't have any. So we calculated the Poisson brackets, and we found that these two were equal to zero, which was good. But then we found that the Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian constraint with the linear constraints was not equal to zero, but it was equal to this quantity here. And this is pretty much where we got last time. It kind of looks like the action. The canonical action with these little t's in the middle and a derivative. So it doesn't look that much like the action. But so what I want to do right now is maybe just give a little bit more intuition for what this guy is. So what we found was that this guy is not equal to zero in general. But the way that you view this in best matching is a constraint on the potential. We require that this thing vanish for certain potentials. And what that does is it tells us that our algebra will be closed provided we have potentials satisfying this equation. So what is this equation? Right? So the physical picture. Yeah, so let's try to get a physical picture of what this means. So I'm just right now trying to give you a physical picture. Just sort of think of this guy. So I'm just sort of the arguments not going to be totally.
Are these potentials like the potentials where you're used to, or?
Yeah, this potential. You start off with this action, and you say that v can be some arbitrary function of the cubes. It can be anything. It can be a polynomial. It can be some exponential. It can be some crazy thing. So we don't put any restrictions whatsoever on the potential. And then what we find is that in order for the algebra to be closed, the potential needs to satisfy this equation. I'll just tell you right now that what it means is that this potential has to be such that the action is agent-bearing. Right? So basically what it's saying is that the potential has to be a function of the distances and the ratios of the distance, depending on what the symmetries you want to impose. If I want to impose symmetry under translations, if I want to say I want to be able to take my system and move it back and forth, then what it's going to mean is that the potential has to depend on the distances, differences between the distances, so that that difference is not going to depend on the relation. That's the idea. But we can see that it's not that hard to actually see that that's what's happening. Because what we can do is we can do a little global gauge transformation. And in a second, I'll justify that it's actually possible to do this gauge transformation. This is a proper gauge transformation to do. But we can go to a frame where the q's turn into the q bars, which are at the top of these early coordinates that are the corrected coordinates. So these guys are just the q's shifted by the group element. So you just you take the q's and you translate them into the best matched position. Okay, that's so. If you go to a gauge where you're dealing with these q bars, then you can see that if you plug this guy into the action, then the derivative of the action with respect to the undotted omegas is equal to this thing, is equivalent to this thing. So let me call this the consistency conditions. So this thing is equivalent to the consistency conditions, right? Because if you just, the action is the kinetic energy minus the potential energy, and you take the derivative with respect to the omegas, and you get, right? So for the potential piece, guy V Q bar di omega is going to look like di v di q bar di q bar di omega. Right? This piece is just omega times q. So q bar. Sorry, not omega. T alpha times q bar. See, and that's the piece we have here. And you do the same thing with the kinetic energy, you find something similar. So the point is that this guy is the partial derivative of this action evaluated at the corrected coordinates with respect to the omega, which basically means that if I take my action, my coordinates, I shift them by this rotation or translation, and then I take the derivative of that, the action is, that derivative is equal to zero. So what it's saying is, the action can't depend on this gauge transformation, basically. So I can shift these coordinates by this amount, and it won't change the action. That's sort of the statement, the action is invariant under global gauge transformation. Now, so these guys, in this substitution, these guys are not functions of time, they're just constant. So this thing is equivalent to global gauge invariance. And that's a little bit different from standard gauge theory. In standard gauge theory, we would start with an action that is already globally gauge invariant. So we would require that the action is globally gauge invariant. And then we would not run into this problem. This would just automatically be equal to zero. And we wouldn't have to deal with this issue. But the nice thing is that in this theory, you can almost derive that your action should be globally gauge invariant. So I don't know. I don't know if there's anything deep here, but it's definitely a different way of thinking about gauge theory. Okay, please. So yeah, we were just going through the stuff that we did last time, and we're trying to get a physical picture for what this constraint means. Okay. So this is when we calculated the Poisson brackets of the constraints. We found that this term had to be equal to zero. And then we were just saying, what does that mean? And what we just showed was that it's equivalent to the global gauge invariance of the action. So just to do a couple examples, to get a little bit more intuition for what this means, this constraint for translations, okay, this piece, remember for translations, the generators of the translations are just derivatives with respect to q, okay? So if we take the derivative with respect to q of a p, you get zero, right? So this term here, pi t alpha pi is equal to 0. And the only term that we have left is this guy. So we have the sum over I of psi v psi qi tl qi. But here, that's the reason why I expanded this out. Because you can write this just as the derivative of v with respect to the omegas for a global thing like that. So the potential. So this is saying, this is equivalent to this, that if you take the system and you rotate it or you translate it, the potential consider the action is going to be invariant under that transformation. So what it says is that the potential is not going to change if I do a translation. That's what this condition is saying. And that another way of saying that is that the potential must be a function of the difference between the coordinates. So this is the center of mass distance, or this is the position of center of mass. So really, any potential that is written in this form, I take some arbitrary coordinate, and then I subtract the center of mass coordinate, it's going to satisfy this equation, which means that the Dirac algebra is going to be closed. Right? For rotations, the generators are these epsilon A, B, I, J, K. And this product between the P's and the P's is a cross product. So obviously, if I take the cross product of the same vector, it's equal to 0. Of a vector with itself, it's equal to 0. So again, we have this condition here, that the potential shouldn't depend on a global gauge transformation. So what that means is that the potential shouldn't depend on a global rotation. So if I take my coordinate system and I do a rotation, that shouldn't change the potential, which is another way of saying that is that the potential should now depend on distances, r, I, and j, between the particles. Because now the potential depends only on the distances between various particles. It certainly will not be affected by these rotations. So potentials of this form are guaranteed to satisfy this. These are guaranteed to satisfy this. So I just want to do this scale transformations because they're a little bit different. Because for the scale transformations, this sort of kinetic energy piece is not equal to 0. It's the t's are delta functions, okay? Which means that this product becomes a dot product. So you have the sum over I of the p squared over mi minus gradient of v dot of q is equal to 0. And this thing, if you actually plug in the equation of motion, which we're going to do in a second. Again, this is just to give you an intuition. You plug in the equations of motion, this turns into a differential equation that you can solve. And the solutions tell you that v must be of this form. It must be homogeneous of degree minus 2 in the cubes, which means that it has to be some sort of constant. And if you take these conditions into account, divided by the square of the distances. So it's a function of that form. So the potential is a function of that form to satisfy all of these conditions. And this is kind of interesting because remember what we've done actually. When we did this, we absorbed E into V. Right? So Julian really likes this because now he has of condition if you require that the action be invariant, the theory be invariant under scale transformations or dilatation. This is the only potential that you can have. And this does not have a constant term E in it, which is another way of saying that the energy has to be equal to zero. Now, the problem is, it would be really nice if this was not squared, this is just the distance, because then it would look like sort of the gravitational force, the electromagnetic force, or the electrostatic force. It would be more familiar, it would be like a potential that's more familiar to us. This thing is bizarre. But I remember, yes.
But what was the argument for the theory that wasn't scale invariant, that taught you that the energy was zero? Because there is an argument that for the relational theory, the energy has to be zero.
I'm not aware of any for the theory that's not relational, spatially relational. So just the Jacobi theory, I'm not aware of an argument. Now, from Julian, I have an argument that we'll see, like maybe today, but probably not. Where if you best match, see, these symmetries are all spatial symmetries, but you can write down the theory that we wrote at the beginning, which is parameterized particle dynamics, where you add T as a dynamical variable. See, once you have T as a dynamical variable, then you can treat it using this technique, and you can best match the time translational symmetry of that action. If you do that, then you have a principle, you apply this Mach constraint, and you find that the energy is equal to zero.
Okay.
The problem with that is that in that action, you still have a V, and the V doesn't have any restrictions on it. So the V can have, so even though the momentum conjugate to time has to be zero, the potential may still have a constant term. So it's a little bit,
sorry, what term?
A term of order zero. So V might be equal to V naught plus some function of R, right? There's nothing restricting. If you don't restrict this, then you can interpret this as the negative of the energy.
Right.
So it's still not clear to me how you interpret this energy differently from the energy that's the variable conjugate to the time. So,
in Julian's books, he basically said we treat time as a dynamical variable when he's doing the non-scale invariant theories, like picking in the end of time. I presume that he would just say, well, V has to be what we expect it to be, and therefore, and energy is zero, and everything's fine. And this argument you gave is an argument that says if you're not willing to take the potential to 1 over R or whatever, then you have a problem. You haven't really found that V is zero.
Right, that's right. Yeah. So the only principle that Julian has that would really require energy equal to zero is a scale invariant. Otherwise, he doesn't know how to do it. It's always there. And in fact, it's even hard to measure. Now, the analog of E in general relativity is a cosmological. So we're getting to general relativity soon. One reason why I'm spending so much time on this stuff is because literally once I write this stuff down, general relativity is going to take almost no time whatsoever. Because general relativity has all the same structure, just different variables. I think it's really good to gain intuition from this stuff. Because you can take all that intuition and you can bring it into general relativity. And the canonical framework and all the problems that arise in general relativity just come out fairly naturally. A lot of the problems are the same. There's only a couple technical complications. Maybe they're more than that, but anyways. Okay. So the main point of all this is that this thing here is just telling you that you need a globally gauging variant action. And then you're okay. Then the algebra is closed and it's first class. First class means that the constraints are zero on shell. The constraints are preserved by the equations of motion on shell. Okay. So what are the equations of motion? Uh, Hamiltonian. And we know that the constraints are first class, so we know we have all the constraints, which means we can work out the equations of motion. The first thing to do is to work out the derivative of the q's. That's just Poisson bracket of this guy with the total Hamiltonian. Now again, the only non-zero Poisson bracket that the q has is with the p's. So if you go and you look into your Hamiltonian and you look for terms of p's, and the only one, well, there's only two. There's this one and there's this one. Okay, so we have n times the sum over I of p I squared over 2mi. And then we have minus n alpha sum over I transpose. So I mean, these are fairly easy to work out. This is just n times pi over mi. Now, this is the piece we had from the Jacobi theory. In a gauge where n is equal to 1, it's exactly the momentum you get in Newtonian mechanics. But now it has this extra piece here due to the spatial symmetries that is just like this. So if we solve for pi, what we have is mi over n, which is the lattice. In general relativity, we call this the lattice. It's the here is just a we think of it as a Lagrange multiplier multiplied by the Hamiltonian constraint, and then this guy is the shift. In this case, we treat the shift as not a dynamical variable, but as a Lagrange multiplier for one of the constraints. This thing turns into q dot I plus n alpha p alpha q I. So you can see there's this structure of covariant derivatives here, where you have a dot, and you have this extra piece, which multiplies the q. So this looks a lot like a covariant derivative. So that's the equation of motion for this guy, except that the n here is arbitrary. So we can now calculate the p dot. And this thing is only going to be non-zero when we have terms with q's in them. The only terms with q's in them in the Hamiltonian are this guy and this guy. So this is going to look like now the p is on the other side, so you get to pick up a minus sign when you do this guy. So you get a minus n and a derivative like this. Newtonian mechanics, this is the term u. In the Jacobi theory, you multiply it by the lattice. But now in this fully relational theory, you pick up an extra term. It's going to have a plus sign because the p is on this side of the q. And it's going to look like n alpha. And actually, I should do so these are the equations of motion. We can rewrite them in an interesting way. I don't know if it's working. The idea now is to take this guy and to plug it into this guy, and then you have your equations of motion. Now they're all going to be in terms of these arbitrary Lagrange multipliers. But what you can do is then you can use the constraints. You can use these constraints to solve for your Lagrange multipliers. And then once you have that, you can plug those back into here, and you get equations of motion in terms of sort of the true degrees of freedom of the system. Now, that's hard to do, actually. In general relativity, it's not even clear that it's possible to do that. Let me just sort of sketch out what we do now.
Sure.
Yes.
What is the interpretation of the second term?
This term here.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of the piece that you would get from the covariant derivative, right? That's the way that I like to think of it. I mean, it's the same sort of piece that you have here, except for now when you're taking a dot with respect to the p. Now, the thing that is kind of weird is that there's a plus here and a minus here. So the covariant derivative for this guy is a plus. The covariant derivative you use for momentum is a minus. And that is the thing that's actually making it really hard for me to solve the thing, because, I'm sort of working on that right now. That's why I don't know if I want to lecture too much about it. But let me just notice that this is what I'll do. Go to a gauge. So go to the gauge n equals 1 and alpha equals 0. This is a very important gauge of general relativity, actually. It makes the equations of motion look really simple. But it's also an important gauge here, because this is the gauge where equations of motion are manifestly equivalent to Newtonian mechanics. Right? Because then what we have is that the momentum is just equal to I q dot, right, and that the p dot is just equal to the gradient of the potential. So you take the derivative of this, plug it in here, and you've got q double dot I times n I is equal to the gradient of the potential, which is the force. So F equals MA. Now, what this means is that in this gauge, Newton's laws are manifestly valid. Okay, so there's always a gauge that you can go to where the currents are going to obey Newtonian, the laws of Newtonian mechanics. But you also have these constraints. Right? These constraints have to be satisfied as well. And so, what are the constraints? In this gauge, the Hamiltonian constraint looks like, p squared over 2mi. That's just going to be mi over 2 times q dot squared. That's the kinetic energy plus the potential energy is equal to 0. Now, don't forget we've absorbed E into V, so if we didn't have the scales, this would just be conservation of energy. All right, so this thing is equivalent to T plus B equals 0. If we take out a factor of minus E plus the normal thing that you would call the potential, then this would be conservation of energy. The linear constraints look like, and then what we can do now that we're on shell is we can plug this into here. So what we have is we have that the sum over I of m I q dot I t alpha q I is equal to 0. So this is just that the total momentum is equal to 0. The total angular momentum is equal to 0, and what we call total dilatational momentum is equal to 0. Basically, the way to interpret the one for the scale transformations is that the derivative of the moment of inertia is equal to zero. So the moment of inertia is considered quantity. So you have those three things.
So that was the way to interpret.
Okay. Let me go a bit slower. Sorry. So for rotations, you have Q dot cross Q equals zero. The total angular momentum of the universe in these coordinates is equal to zero. Translations, you have the derivative of this guy is just equal to 1, so it's just these momentum equals 0. The total momentum of the universe in this point is 0. And then the scale transformations look like dot products. So Q dot dotted with Q, but you can write this as half of the derivative of Q dot the square of Q. So this looks like the derivative with respect to lambda of the sum over I of mi Q dot squared. And this thing is the moment of inertia. And this is just the moment of inertia of the system. So it's the same thing as saying that I dot is a, so that the moment of inertia is equal to certain quantity. That's the way to interpret what these constraints are. So this gauge is fairly, is a nice gauge to work in. Yeah.
Sorry, am I right in thinking that sort of makes sense that if I sort of imagine a scale non-invariant theory, then I sort of blow up something by a factor of 2, and of course the moment of inertia increases because all the positions.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So what you want to do is the relational variables are going to be scaled down, the square root of the moment of inertia. So what's happening is, yeah, as you get bigger, you take the moment of inertia to scale it back down, basically. So that in the coordinates that you're working with, nothing has changed. As you scale everything out. So it's kind of nice. But the other thing, so understanding, if somebody asks the question, how do you interpret this condition? Why, how do you understand that this is, this should be the thing, the restriction you should expect to have on the potential. And the way to see that actually is imagine I do a global scale transformation of my coordinates here. So if I multiply Q by some number A times Q, then what happens is you'll get a factor of A squared on the bottom here. And in the kinetic, so you get a factor of A squared in the bottom. And in the kinetic energy, you have two Q's, between the derivative of them. But then the A's come outside the derivative. So you get two factors of A on the top of the T, and two factors of A from the bottom of the T, and they cancel. But you're always going to get two A's on the top because of the kinetic energy, just because of the form of the kinetic energy. So the reason why you need to have a potential that goes like 1 over r squared is so that you can get that cancellation, basically. So that you get a cancellation between the scale that you get here and versus here, and they cancel each other out now. And the day you have an action, it's invariant under that scale. So that's the way to understand the scaling. And this is the way to understand the constraints that you get. Now, the thing that is strange about this theory is that, okay, in this gauge, everything looks very nice, and it's easy to interpret. But what happens when you go to other gauges? If you go to other gauges, it starts to get really hairy. But the funny thing is, and I'm still not 100% clear on this, you can do some interesting things. And it might be important for general relativity, because in general relativity, you don't understand how to get up to 3 degrees of freedom. But what you can solve for age-independent equations of motion. So the procedure that I talked about was, what you do is you take these equations of motion here, and then you plug them into the constraints. And you try to solve for the constraint. Try to solve for these arbitrary parameters. And then you sub them back into the equations of motion. So it's pretty straightforward to do this for the laps. Because if I take the Hamiltonian constraint, right, and I use, instead of fixing this particular gauge n equals 0, I just leave these guys arbitrary, what I get is that the Hamiltonian constraint is a sum of the momenta. So it's 1 over 2 mi times mi squared q dot I plus n alpha t alpha qi. And then there's this factor n squared that comes out. This thing is squared plus b equals 0. So what I can do now, because n, I can pull the n out of the sum, this is a kind of a part of the number, I can solve for n, right? So I get that n is going to be equal to minus this guy, which is mi over 2 times this thing. Divided by b, right? So this is just the kinetic energy evaluated at the covariant derivative of the qis. Okay. Now, I don't know if you remember way back at the beginning of the course when we did Jacobi's theory. What we found is that this kinetic energy divided by minus v, that's exactly what, that was a gauge invariant quantity. It was measured in terms of the q's only. So we could take that, and we could plug it back into here, and into here. And then we could get equations of motion in terms of this little thing that we called ephemeris time. Remember? We called this thing the derivative of the ephemeris time. And then we said that you can have Newton's laws obeyed with, instead of having the dots, you know, the derivative with respect to this ephemeris time. And now you and then the same thing with this constraint here, that now instead of having the kinetic energy evaluated at where you take derivatives with respect to lambda, you take derivatives with respect to this age-independent variable that we call the ephemeris time, and then you have kinetic energy in terms of that quantity there. So what we found was that by solving for n, we had Newton's laws were valid, and all these constraints were valid with lambda going to this new variable, which was gauge independent. And to me, that seemed very suggestive as saying something like, how come we have one gauge where the equations of motion take the same form as the gauge-independent equations of motion? So the idea was that the true degrees of freedom obey the same equation, but instead of a dy lambda, it's this dy ephemeris time. And I'm wondering, and still am kind of wondering whether or not this might be something more generic. If you can do something now with spatial symmetries where you have a gauge where the gauge-independent equations of motion are satisfied. And so let me keep going, because I actually want to put a bit more meat on that argument. I'm going to have to start erasing some notes.
Sean, can I just ask a question?
Yes.
This might be a stupid question, but where you derive the equations of motion, you sort of implicitly assume that qi and pi commute, right? But then it looks like n depends on qi.
Yeah. So on shell, once you see, there's a different, like, n is some independent function of the piece in the outer space. So it doesn't depend on anything until you apply the equations of motion. Once the equations of motion have been applied, so now that you're on shell, then you can use n to find it as an explicit function of the piece of the cubes. But off shell, you don't have that in general. So, no, it's a very good question, and it's easy to get confused about this point. So what I just did to solve for the n, I can try to solve for the lattice. And in general, you can do this, but it's a lot easier to do it in specific for the specific groups. So for the translations, this equation of motion now looks like this derivative acts this way, right? And so what happens is this derivative will kill the p. So
how come it acts that way?
Because of the way the notation is kind of hard to manage. But when you work through everything properly, you find the derivative acts this way. The thing is, if I take the transpose away, these guys flip, and now the derivative acts. So what you have is you have the p dot here. Now I'm just going to use vectors. It's equal to minus the lattice, which is a gradient of potential. And then you don't have this extra piece. So with the translations, you don't have any extra piece here. But for the I'll just remind you that the Q dot plus. Okay. So now here the derivative acts on this Q, and you're left just with this vector n. Okay. So this thing turns into the momentum is equal to mi over the lattice times qi dot plus this vector n. Okay. Now, we take this. Now the idea is, again, to take this and plug it into the linear constraint here with the Mach constraint applied. So we've got this thing is equal to 0. And we're going to try to solve for this vector n. Okay. So the idea is to, actually, I didn't even need to do this, but that's OK. We'll need it later. We've got the sum over i of mi over n times q dot I plus this vector n. And this guy acting on this guy is a constant, it's just one. So this whole thing is equal to zero. Right? Now, the n drops out this, which is nice, because now we can solve explicitly for this guy. This guy is just going to be equal to minus the sum over mi of the momenta. Divided by the total mass. This is the same thing as the velocity of the center mass. Right? So n is minus the velocity of the center mass. So what we have is now we have kind of a new set of coordinates. What it's telling us is we need to go to a new set of coordinates, which are the center of mass coordinates, which is exactly what I was sort of saying over here. Potential has to depend on center of mass coordinates. So you're finding something pretty interesting here. And we plug that back in. And remember, I actually solved for the first time. So if you plug that in here, it's just saying, this ephemeris time is kinetic energy calculated in the center of mass reference frame. Right? So now, if you're just talking about translations, you have this really nice picture that the equations of motion just look like Newton's laws in the center of mass reference frame, where the total momentum is equal to zero. So, which is kind of interesting.
Can you remind me why that's the kinetic energy in the center of mass reference frame?
Because this is the kinetic energy divided by this covariant derivative, right? Mm-hmm. But the covariant derivative, we found once we apply this we solve for n, is just equal to q dot minus q center of mass dot. Right? So these are the coordinates translated into the center of mass reference frame. And then, so I know I'm going fast, but I'm not really tying it together very well. But if you now take this equation for n and you plug it into here, right, what you find is that p dot, p is now just sort of m d by d lambda of 1 and n I over n of this center of mass coordinate. Right, is equal to minus n gradient of v. And you bring this n out here, and what you have is you have d by d lambda times n, d by d lambda times n is equal to gradient v, right? So if we call the ephemeris time, so if we call d by d lambda times 1 over n equals to d by d ephemeris time. I'm just reminding you guys of what I did a long time ago. Not all of you guys are here for that. But if I call this quantity equal, I just call this thing right here, then the equations of motion reduced to d squared dt ephemeris squared of qi minus qi, sorry, the center mass. You get this. So these are the equations of motion in terms of the gauge independent quantities, right? So this is a gauge independent equation of motion. And the other thing, I mean, we need to apply the constraints, but the constraints are just that the kinetic energy is conserved in the center of mass frame. and the momentum is zero at the center of mass spring.
Question?
Yes.
I thought you'd proven that n itself was equal to the ephemeris time. One of these right-hand borders.
Sorry, the derivative of the ephemeris time.
Okay, thank you. That's okay.
That's okay. So again, it's again suggested that you have this gauge, this distinguished gauge, where you have these equations of motion, and you have all of these, you have conservation of energy, conservation of momentum. But then when you solve, when you don't fix a gauge, and you just try to solve for these guys using the constraints, you find that you have exactly the same equations of motion, but now in these sort of relational variables. So like, I would call the relational time the ephemeris time, and then I would call the center of mass coordinates the relational variables. And then you just have these equations of motions are the equations of motion in terms of the relational variables. So I'm not sure if this is just an accident, but you get it just for these symmetry groups. But I'm working on trying to do this in general, because if you could do this in general relativity, it would be really interesting, because we don't know how to do this inversion. The inversion that I did here to solve for n, it's very difficult to do that in general relativity. But if this is true, then even if you don't know how to do that inversion, you can still tell the equations of motion that your relational variables, your observables are going to satisfy, which is maybe important, maybe interesting.
Can you potentially get a guess for what your Rankine plot should be by conjecturing that the equations of motion have the same form, relational variables, and then plug that back in and verify that it is correct?
That's what I've been doing, yeah. And I'm a little bit bothered by this minus sign. This plus sign, actually. If this was a minus sign, it would be very easy to show that you have these relational variables that are equal to g times q, and where g is the exponent of the shift times these guys. If there was a plus sign. But for some reason, instead of having the covariant derivative acting twice, because this thing is the covariant derivative, instead of having it acting twice, you have it acting, and then you have it evaluated at the negative acting. And I don't understand why that's there. And I can't look through, like, it's a very simple argument to show that should not be, this should be a plus. But then I looked at one of Julian's old papers where he does something in different variables. But it looks like he doesn't have, he has a minus sign here. It's very hard to trust those calculations, though. So, anyways, I'm a little bored for you with the details of this, but I think that that doing, if you could show that you can do this, then there's at least a formal way to do this here for an arbitrary group. That might be really useful. In general relativity, the group is a group of diffeomorphisms. Right? So you have it's a very, very complicated group. Right? And it's not clear exactly how to think about it. So let me maybe make a couple. I haven't even talked about the equations of motion for Chandra. We're almost out of time. I haven't talked about the equations of motion for the omegas and the pis, but they're actually very easy, very straightforward to evaluate. So maybe I should just do that quickly. And then So so the omega dots are the plus one bracket and omegas with the flow of M20. So really what all we're looking for here is the constraints are occurrences of pi's. And there's two. There's one in the linear constraint, and then there's one in the Mach constraint. So you get two Lagrange multipliers. N alpha plus N alpha. So this thing has like, it's very arbitrary. It's just two arbitrary functions added together. It turns out that the first guy, pi alphas are pi's with full Hamiltonian. And now you're just looking for occurrences of omegas, but there is none in this action, or in this Hamiltonian. So these guys are equal to zero, which means that these momenta are conserved quantities, which is another way of saying that the pi alphas are equal to two, dots are equal to zero. It's another way of saying that the pi alphas are constants. And now you see what the role of the Mach constraint is. The role of the Mach constraint is just to set those constants equal to zero. So in normal Hamiltonian mechanics, you still have this constraint, right? That this quantity here is the total generalized momentum, and it's a conserved quantity. What the Mach constraint does is it says that quantity has to be equal to zero. Now it's interesting because from the point of view of a quantum theory, these guys get promoted to operators, right? So in a quantum theory, the pi alphas go to little pi alpha hats, right? But if you have a Mach constraint, so typically you have something like this, equal to, if this is like a constant of the motion, it would be equal to some constant. On a shell, it's equal to a constant. But if you don't, if you just sort of, you take your theory and you promote variables into operators, then you get something like this. But what the Mach constraint does is it restricts this operator to have a single eigenvalue, and that eigenvalue is zero. And so basically what's happening is that you're not allowed to have superpositions of these things anymore. So before, if you don't have a Mach constraint, then your wave function can be superpositions of angular momentum eigenstates, for example. But once you impose this constraint, then you're not allowed to have those superpositions anymore. And you're only allowed to have a single angular momentum or momentum eigenstate. Now, we've seen this before, right? When we looked at the time and we quantized the time theory, we found that in general, in a time-independent theory, if you you could have superpositions of energy eigenstates, but in the relational theory, you were restricted to a single energy, and so then you had this time-independent Schrödinger equation. What I'm saying is that just trying to point out this is a generic feature. That whenever you have a relational theory, or whenever you have this Mach constraint here, what it does to your quantum theory is it restricts you to a particular eigenstate of this operator here. Okay? And if this operator happens to be the total energy of the universe, then you're stuck in an energy eigenstate, and you have a problem of time.
Do you mean eigenstate or eigenspace? Presumably the zero energy eigenspace could be larger than one dimensional.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, the zero generalized momentum eigenspace.
So you could have degenerate states. So you're at eigenspace. efficiency. So you could have to, I mean, in principle, you could have to generate energy, say. And really, that's what you want. I mean, really what you want is to show that, for example, you know, you can have a multi-particle system, and you just need to have the total angular momentum is equal to zero. So you can still have many states that satisfy that. And somehow, within the extra states that you have in this eigenspace, you should be able to recover dynamics that look like laboratory quantum mechanics. So if you believe in relationalism, yes, you believe that this operator has zero eigenvalue. But that doesn't mean that if I do quantum mechanics in the laboratory, I'm going to get a zero eigenvalue when I measure this operator for the subsystem that I have. Right? So somehow, there has to be some sense that if I trace over the degrees of freedom of the rest of the universe, I can still have non-zero, I can still have superpositions of what I call my local angular moment. And therefore, quantum mechanics is, laboratory quantum mechanics is still relational in that sense. Now, nobody's actually been able to provide an adequate theory of exactly how to do that trace over extra degrees of freedom and prove that you can do it. But it's very similar to the situation we had in classical mechanics, where you have Newton's bucket, and Newton is saying, well, the relational theory is not giving me laboratory physics. It's telling me that, it's telling me something different from what I observed. And then Mach is saying, well, really, you have all these other stars. And when you take into account the effect of all the stars in the universe, then you have this sort of emergent local frame of reference. And it looks like an absolute reference frame. So it looks like you have a theory in absolute space. And the same thing is expected to happen in a quantum theory as well, that if you trace over all the stars, the effect of all those things, that that gives you a sort of emergent local reference frame where you have, where you can approximately have real quantum mechanics. The problem is it's a lot harder to work that out properly in a quantum.
Is it an inaccuracy in what you say? You don't want to trace out over the environment of the system, because what you want to do is you want to take the system and its environment and decompose that tensor product over space into collective degrees of freedom and relational degrees of freedom. And so, you know, if I have two spins or two spin J's, then I'm interested in the rotationally invariant degrees of freedom. Then the whole thing, the Hilbert space, breaks up into sum over the total J's. And in each of those irreducible representations, you have a Hilbert space that carries the collective and Hilbert space that carries the relational degrees of freedom.
Right.
And it's those Hilbert spaces that carry the relational degrees of freedom that are the ones you're interested in. So it's not a trace over the environment, it's a trace over collective. And furthermore, there's this extra complication that it's not necessarily even a tensor product of collective and relational. It can be a direct sum of tensor products. So I suspect that actually in the literature that's part of the confusion. That I've seen lots of people say right now we trace over the environment to get the relation of freedom, and that's not what we do.
Yeah, it's not as simple. Yeah, I think that there's a couple of people that have looked at this and they have very sketchy results. And I think that it could just be because people are not really doing it properly. I have some ideas about how you can do it for with path integrals, which is a very different way of thinking of it. Where you have, because in the path integral formalism, you don't really see the difference between, you can see all you can maybe start to see the difference between the relational theory and the background-dependent theory is this Mach constraint. If you lift this constraint, if you just say, I'm not going to apply this anymore, I'm only going to have this, then what happens is that these constants of motion become functions of the boundary conditions. So I have some configuration space with Qs and omegas, and I specify various initial Qs and initial omegas and final Qs and final omegas. And what that does, once I specify omegas at the endpoints, is it tells me exactly how much of a translation I have at the end of the day. So basically that is it tells me exactly what my initial momentum, my momentum should be, what my angular momentum should be. And then I have essentially Newtonian mechanics. Because I have Newtonian mechanics, I mean, these things are conserved in Newtonian mechanics, right? Because we have potentials of particular forms. So these guys are, this is the same as Nether's theorem, right? All we've done is we've made pi dynamical variables. And then, so the theory with fixed endpoints is just Newtonian mechanics, there's no difference. And when you quantize it, you get Newtonian mechanics without any change at all. Because you can have superpositions of these states. But in the path integral, in the path integral formalism, it's very, in the canonical framework, it's kind of awkward because you have to add this constraint and it's not clear how well motivated it is. But in the path integral, all you have to do is when you're evaluating your path integral, is you put delta functions at the endpoint to enforce various boundary conditions, and that gives you an absolute. That tells you exactly how much the omegas have changed from the initial and final state. So you put these delta functions everywhere in the measure. And then that's actually fairly easy to think through. And then if you want a free endpoint variation, you take those delta functions away. So the way to get an emergent background from the path integral perspective is you start with an action that allows the omegas to be free of the boundary, you just integrate over them. And then you try to find a way to get that theory to flow into a theory where you have delta functions. So you can do it, and there's techniques to do this, where you have, using renormalization group flow, you can have these delta functions and you can spread them out and stuff. So you start with ones that are spread out and you get them to collapse into delta functions. Then you use the final mechanism for doing that. But anyway, so there's a lot of different ways of doing it. I think it's interesting that the people that try to do this are all from a quantum information background, typically. And so they do it using techniques from quantum information. I came from a field theory background, so the first thing I thought of was the path integral. I don't know. Anyways, it's interesting. In general relativity, we have this, people have made the same claims that, you know, you have these diffeomorphism constraints, and then you have this problem of time. And they say, well, the way to recover space-time is to sort of start averaging over things and taking various limits. No one's been able to do it yet. So anyways, that's maybe why it's interesting to look at this stuff. Anyone have any other comments? I mean, we're pretty much, I think I've said everything that I want to say. I mean, you can show that these first-class constraints generate these transformations, and you can show what they are. I don't think it's worth going through. So I think I'm done with the Barber-Pritzky theory. There's just not that much more that we can pull from this. So anyone have any comments or questions?
So, let's see if I can remember the question. Something that's always troubled me. Basically, if I look at some system of particles in the regular Newtonian theory, then the internal dynamics is independent of the velocity relative to the distance parts. Right? So the velocity of the center of mass relative to the distance parts. That's the principle of relativity. Now, if I'm in a relational theory, I need to derive that fact.
Yes.
I mean, it's not something I'm assuming any longer. So, has that been done in Barber-Pritchard theory? Can you rederive Galilean relativity?
I think it's the type of thing that is always said that it's obvious that you can do it, but I don't know of any actual attempts. If somebody wrote a paper where they proved that, yes, you can do this. But there's a couple of very easy arguments, right? You can just say, look, the angular momentum has to, so the only difference, if you look at the equations, right, in this cage, in the Or if you look at it in, just if you're talking about translation, say, you don't have to even go to a particular page. Then, what am I saying? Then you can just say that, well, I have Newtonian mechanics, I have these extra constraints. Right? So what are these, what is that system, how is this system going to look equivalent to Newtonian mechanics? Well, it is going to be equivalent if one of these terms is massively dominant over the other ones, right? And if you have fixed stars, then the angular momentum of the fixed stars is, as far as we know, it should be average out to zero because the universe is homogeneous and actually isotropic. But the point is that a small variation local angular momentum can easily be counterbalanced by the fixed stars because A, they're so far away, so their Qs are huge, and B, their masses are also significantly more than any of the masses in the systems we have here. So the point is that the local system can have any angular momentum. There's no way to experimentally verify that angular momentum is being absorbed into the fixed stars. We can never really perform an experiment accurate enough to measure that. So that's the proof, basically.
So I'm missing step. How's that a proof that Galilean relativity holds?
Ooh.
That the internal dynamics of a system particle is independent of its velocity relative to the distance terms.
Oh. Right, because if you do a Galilean boost, right, you're changing the momentum of this system. And the point is that if the momentum of the universe could counterbalance that easily without any noticeable experimental. There's no experiment that we could do that could sort of show that, yes, indeed, the rest of the universe has absorbed this momentum. So that the total momentum of the universe is still zero. Right. So I suppose that'd be the way that we put it for me.
And it strikes me as an attempt to show that the total momentum is zero to sort of indicate the theory.
Right.
It seems to me to be different from.
No, but what it's saying is that this local subsystem can have any momentum. Well, not any momentum, but any momentum provided it's small compared to the momentum of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll essentially have the same situation you have in Galilean relativity where you can take the system, you can boost it to a large velocity, and the equations of motion are still going to be. We're still going to have these equations of motion. The only difference, these equations of motion are always going to be valid. I mean, notice that.
The fact that there's one frame in which Galilean relativity holds.
Yeah. That's why I think it's important to try to understand what these other gauges are actually meaning. Like, because Julian, I mean, when I first did this, he was like, oh, if you go to another gauge, it's not going to look anything like these are. They'll look totally weird things. And I wasn't so convinced that that's true, which is why I did this calculation. I found that it's not all that different in the different gauges. It's easy to solve this for the scale and variance too, actually. And what you find is that you have these relational variables. The Q relationals are Qs divided by molar inertia, squared molar inertia. So you kind of scale it up by molar inertia. This thing has dimensions of length times square root of mass. And you can do things greater than mass, but basically, you write your theory to do this, and and it works out perfectly, but because of the minus sign, you actually get a factor of moment of inertia. So 3/2 on this side, which is a little bit ugly, but if you do it for the two-dimensional rotations, you can solve for it as well, because there's only one parameter, which is the bubble of rotation. And what do you get? You find that you have this, with the that theta, the derivative of it is like the angle of all of the particles divided by times r squared of the particle divided by the moment of inertia. So it's kind of like some weird weighted average of all the angles of all the particles in the universe, and then you just rotate your system by that amount. Then again, you can write the equation of motion in terms of those variables with very simple things. So it's, I can't do it for the 3D rotations in general. So I think that the answer to your question is that, like, it's just the type of thing that people just say, yeah, everything works in this cage, so everything's nice. But I think it's worth actually looking at other cages, because in general relativity, it's the same thing. People like to not work in particular cages in general relativity. Okay, so it's been a long time. I have no other questions.
Thank you.
That's all.